Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Much of the drama around the Northern Pass hydropower project has focused on the transmission lines, where they'd go, how tall their towers would be, how it would all affect landscapes and property values. But what about the electricity itself, generated far away in northern Quebec? How has that process affected the province's environment, economy, and peoples? These questions took NHPR's Outside In team on a six-month investigation, traveling more than 4,000 miles and interviewing dozens of sources, including many native Canadians whose views on hydropower aren't as clear-cut as you might think. We learn more this hour in The Exchange with NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown. He's host of Outside In, and Sam, welcome, and thank you for helping us out today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So how much did the genesis of this series, Sam, come from the long Northern Pass debate that you have covered for at least 6 years?
So I'd say it's kind of been a slow burn over the years of you know, knowing very little about the company that was selling, that would have been selling the electricity over the Northern Pass line, learning tidbits here or there, and sort of everything I learned got me more and more fascinated about the source of this power. And then as we started to dig into it and thought over at Outside In that, yes, what we really should do is we should investigate the source of the power, you come to realize the deep and complicated history of this utility and how tied it is not just to sort of French-Canadian identity, but also how interactions with Indigenous people have really shaped the way in which the entire Canadian nation interact with its First Nations.
It is fascinating, and it is complicated. Just a couple basic questions first, Sam, before we get into that history. Why is Hydro-Québec so eager to sell its power to us here in New England? And let's just say Northern Pass isn't the only project out there by Hydro-Québec.
Right. Well, and as it stands right now, there are three power lines that are proposed that are competing with each other, all of which are partners with Hydro-Québec. There are two others that would connect to Canada that are connecting to other power sources, but there are three that would connect to Hydro-Québec that are competing to get this contract with Massachusetts. But that said, I mean, One could argue that exports outside of Quebec have been a key strategy in Hydro-Québec's business plan since its inception. And if you look at their revenues right now, they sell 16% of their electricity out of the province, but that 16% accounts for 28% of their revenue. So, you know, they're in this unique position of having the cheapest electricity in North America and being neighbors with the region that has the most expensive electricity in the continent.
What a gift, right?
Exactly.
From a business perspective.
Exactly. They you know, just build a power line, you know, send an extension cord over, and suddenly those electrons are worth, you know, one-third or twice as much.
They've got a lot of it, too. I was struck listening to this series, Sam. You know, they've got a massive amount of hydropower. Everything about Hydro-Québec is big. There are pictures on the Outside In website, and I encourage listeners to check them out. But just describe for us now, if you could please, Sam, the overwhelming size of everything this company does.
Yeah, no, I thought this question might be asked, so I have a few figures here. One of the projects we visited, the Robert-Bourassa Dam, which is their largest generating facility, the central dam itself is nearly 2 miles long.
The dam itself is 2 miles long?
And that's just one dam, because this is very, very flat terrain up there. They also had to build 29 dikes, which are sort of secondary earthen structures to keep the water from sort of leaking out the sides of the reservoir. So a 2-mile long long dam, 29 dikes. And to get to that project, in order to build it, they built a road that is 620 kilometers in order to get up to that project, which, to put that in context, that's a road that would take you from Concord, New Hampshire, down to Delaware. So it's simply astonishing. I mean, these are public works on a scale that are completely unimaginable, I think, in the sort of American context.
Well, and you and Hannah McCarthy visited one of these ginormous dams. What was that like, Sam? There's some really great descriptions in the piece.
Well, it's actually fascinating. I mean, it's very clear that these dams are a great source of pride for French Canadians because they open them to tours. They have really, you know, thousands of people go through them every year. We actually visited three dams, two of which are tourist attractions. And it's a lot like visiting the Hoover Dam, except they're just so much more massive and remote. That's the other thing, is they're very far out there. And, you know, it's just simply impossible to comprehend what it's like until you've stood under one of these things. And I think the other thing that's really hard to grasp is just the size of Canada. I mean, the James Bay project, which is where about 50% of Hydro-Québec's generating capacity sits, is over an area the size of France. I mean, it's astonishing. It's really it's difficult to comprehend.
Well, I remember once driving up from New Hampshire through New Brunswick, Canada, and just thinking, you know, aren't we there yet? I mean, it is huge. And I think either you or Hannah says in the first piece, there's a wind that's created.
Yeah, this was in the Robert Bourassa facility. They actually let you go stand under the turbine itself, under the rotor in the turbine. And so, you know, if for sort of hydropower 101, the water starts uphill, it runs downhill, it goes through a set of sort of blades that's called the turbine, and it spins a rotor, which is a 600-ton electromagnet, and that's how the electricity is generated. They let you go and stand under that 600-ton spinning magnet, and it's just like the only thing I can say is it's indescribable.
Well, and I want to again direct folks to the website. You can look at the pictures. You've got some videos there as well, Sam. And you can join us now with your questions and comments about this, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the Exchange, NHPR's Outside In goes all the way to the source of Canadian hydropower in far northern Quebec. In a new series called Powerline, Outside In host Sam Evans-Brown and reporter Hannah McCarthy explore the complex history of Hydro-Québec, how and why it began, and the enormous impact it's had on Quebec, its environment, and its people, including Canada's Native Americans, or what they call First Nation. You can join us now with your questions and comments. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Sam, you touched on this a minute ago, so let's talk about it a little bit more. In the series, you talk about how French Canadians see Hydro-Québec as evidence of pride, of a resurgent, back in the 60s, political and economic clout after a long history of feeling second class to English speakers. Let's hear this explained by one of the people you interviewed, a gentleman named Daniel Saleh.
When I was a kid in the 1960s, they were building the Manicouagan Dam. I can remember that it was something really to be proud of, because we here in Quebec, the little French Canadians who were, you know, just a generation before, were hardly able to amount to anything economically. We were building those huge dams. It's extremely important. It's important for, of course, for what it achieved, but it's symbolically important as well, because for us, Hydro-Québec is a very powerful symbol. I mean, if you dismantle Hydro-Québec, it would be like dismantling us.
Again, that's Daniel Saleh in Outside In's new series called Powerline, exploring the source of Hydro-Québec's power. And, you know, you say in this series, Sam, French Canadians call Hydro-Québec a jewel. They're so proud of it. And you guys kind of say, who says it about their power company?
Yeah,
so go ahead.
It's a bill on the fridge,
right,
that you shout at usually. Yeah. No, I mean, what you have to understand is that it was created, first of all, in the 1930s, most of the hydroelectric facilities in Quebec were owned by either American corporations, so Duke Energy owned a lot of them, or Anglo-Canadians, sort of descendants of the British people that came in after the British conquest. And so they were sort of a symbol of these long simmering resentments that French Canadians had against Anglos. And this goes all the way back. I mean, there's this thing called the Durham Report that was issued, in which a colonial governor argued that French Canadians were a people without history or culture and should be assimilated. And so it goes way, way back to to the conquest of French Canada by the British. And so Hydro-Quebec was really a tool for sort of retaking this province for the French-Canadian majority. And that tool, you know, the way they exercised it was first buying up all the hydroelectric facilities around the cities, Montreal and Quebec City, in 1944. And then in 1962, there was the second nationalization. And it was – they held a snap election. And the sole issue of that snap election was whether or not to do this second nationalization, in which they bought up all of the dams and powerhouses in the entire province. And a fun fact that didn't make it into the podcast is actually they went to the sort of Canadian equivalent of Wall Street, and the whole scheme felt a little too pink for those folks, so they turned it down. They
said a state-owned energy company.
Right. Yeah. So they weren't going to finance the project. So instead, the Canadians went to American Wall Street, and our Wall Street financed it.
Really?
Indeed.
That's interesting. So Hydro-Quebec is a crown company then. In other words, it's a state-owned company. Why is that so important, Sam, to this whole broader story?
Well, first of all, just fiscally, they send a $2 billion dividend into the Quebecois budget every year. And so that's a big chunk of change. It's about 2% of the Quebecois government is the revenues come from this one company. And that's money that otherwise would be going to private shareholders. So that's one thing. But also, if you just look at this history of when this company was created, this was a time where French Canadians tended to have, less education. They tended to earn less money. They tended to not achieve positions of authority in government or business. And so this was a way to, Daniel Salé talks about how the work sites you'd go to the chantier and it'd be in French. They'd be speaking French on the job. And that was a new thing. And it used to be that in the early days of dam building, the work sites were the foremen were all speaking English, and they'd give instructions for how to use dynamite in English. And so young French Canadians who didn't speak English were often killed in accidents because they didn't understand the instructions they would be giving.
Well, when I heard that story, I thought, no wonder the French Canadians felt put upon. I mean, that's a egregious example where you don't give people instruction in their own language so they don't get blown up.
Indeed. And so I think it's really difficult to overestimate how important this company was in terms of something that French Canadians could sort of identify with.
Whose idea was it to, buy up all these little smaller plants? I wonder where he or she got the money, and then to make it this big mega thing, try and present it to the government, find the financing. I mean, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, so the first nationalization was done under a premier named Lesage, but a lot of people point to René Lévesque, who also went on to found the Parti Québécois, which, if you know anything about French-Canadian politics, you know that the Parti Québécois is the party that advocated for seceding from Canada. And so that really tells you something, that the same gentleman who was the sort of progenitor of Hydro-Quebec later went on to found his political career on trying to create a French-Canadian nation north of New England.
Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Sam, obviously, when you dam up rivers, things happen, and people are living on these areas, Native Canadians, First Nation, as they're called in Canada. Who was first affected by this back in the 60s when this was really getting going?
So After the second nationalization, the first projects were on the north shore of the Gulf of St. Lawrence. So if you sort of, you know, the first dams were close to Quebec City and Montreal. And then as you dam up all those rivers, you start to move outward in sort of concentric circles away from the population centers. And so the first ones were the Betsimet River and then later the Manicouagan and the Outard Rivers. Those were where that was where sort of this fledgling crown corporation got its sea legs. That's where they figured out how to build really, really huge projects. These areas were the traditional territory of a band of First Nation people called the Pessimit. So this is the Innu Nation, the Pessimit community, and all of these rivers were on their traditional hunting and trapping territory.
Which seems amazing to us today that somebody would just walk in and say, cool, look at this river. I think I'll dam it up and make a gazillion dollars, you know, selling hydropower from it. And not once saying, oh, is there anybody else here who, you know, might be disrupted by this?
Well, you have to understand that this was part of a broader policy within Canadian government at the time. There was what's now referred to as sedentarization going on, where you had First Nations were nomadic people. They would range from deep inland in the winter where they were hunting and trapping especially for beaver skin. And then in the spring, they would come back down to the shore where they would sell the furs that they had accumulated to white fur traders. And this is a rhythm that had been going on for centuries, basically since the fur traders first arrived in the New World. The Canadian government sort of saw this as problematic and was working very hard to stamp out this way of life. Because if you have people ranging across this huge space, that then is land that you can't use for other purposes, ostensibly. And so many people perhaps have heard about the policy of residential schools, which Canada actually apologized for and paid reparations for this policy because of the abuses that were entailed. But that was huge in terms of if you're sending your kids to school in the winter, they're not learning the skills they need in order to be able to survive in the wilderness during the winter. So it's a broader policy of trying to get people to stay in one place, typically small reservations on the coast that were sort of cordoned off and said, this is the spot where we want you to live year round.
But that's not how they had lived, and that's not really how they wanted to live.
Indeed. And they often basically, you know, ignored this policy. They would continue to just live the way they wanted to live, which is why when Hydro-Québec started to build dams, they were perhaps assuming that you know, this population had been sedentarized. They had been sort of pinned down.
Settled.
Yeah, exactly.
Or at least for our definition, they're settled.
Right. But instead, what they found is that there were still people living this traditional nomadic lifestyle who were impacted by the creation of the dams.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that, Sam. Here in this clip, we're going to hear Louis Archambault. He's translating the words of a Pessimit elder, Edgar Saint-Onge, who describes what it was like for his community when the rivers were first dammed. Let's hear.
Everything has been drowned. They lost all their gears. Their camps were flooded. Their equipment for hunting equipment, trapping equipment was flooded. Their canoes, the nets to fish for the living of their family. Everything was lost without any kind of compensation.
Again, that's a clip from Outside In's new series, Powerline, looking at the roots of Canadian hydropower. And in that clip, we heard from a Pessimit elder who was displaced, whose peoples were displaced by the damming of rivers and the creation of hydropower by Hydro-Québec. Sam Evans-Brown is here. And coming up in a few minutes after a short break, Sam, we'll do a little time up for what you call First Nation 101, because there are several key groups who come up in this saga, and they had different experiences with Hydro-Québec, very different experiences. So we'll talk about that after a short break. By the way, the series Powerline begins this weekend. You can hear it on air starting tomorrow at 3. You can also listen to all four stories by subscribing to the Outside In podcast, so check that out. And coming up after a short break, you can join us with your questions and comments. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More in a moment.
Looking for a good read or want to learn how to write one, NHPR's podcasts have got you covered.
I was hoping you could talk a little bit about those moments and how you saw them fitting into the book.
Well, I don't think it's...
Do you edit as you're going along, or do you tend to write it all out and then go back and edit at the end?
At the very beginning, when I started...
Subscribe to The Bookshelf, 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, and all NHPR's podcasts on iTunes and Google Play.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we go to the source of Canadian hydropower through a new series by NHPR's Outside In. Host Sam Evans-Brown is with us. He and producer Hannah McCarthy spent 6 months investigating this story. You can hear their four-part series on air starting tomorrow at 3, or you can listen to all four stories by subscribing to the Outside In podcast. And as always, you can join us now with your questions. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So Sam, a big part of this story is the impact of Hydro-Québec's expansion on First Nation peoples in Canada. Just remind us who some of the key groups are who come up in this saga, because as we'll learn, they had very different experiences with Hydro-Québec.
Yeah, and sort of, you know, First Nations 101 here. A lot of times First Nations refer to themselves by the name of the community that they live in, or they can refer to themselves by the overarching nation that they belong to. And so, for instance, the ones we were just talking about are the Pessimit, that's the name of their community, and they're part of the Innu Nation, which is sort of their language group.
So not Inuit, which is a term many Americans might be familiar
right.
with.
Right, the Inuits are farther north. The Innu are sort of neighbors, but they're slightly south of the Inuit. But then we also spend a great deal of time talking about the Cree Nation, who after this first mega project was built, the Manik-Utard project that impacted the Pessimit, Hydro-Québec set their sights on the James Bay region, which is where the Crees live. And that project actually impacted both the Crees and the Inuit, the Crees and the Inuit sort of banded together to fight back. They lawyered up, as we say in the podcast, to file an injunction against Hydro-Québec, saying that they were never notified and Hydro-Québec didn't have the right to build without notifying or compensating them.
So the Pessimit were really the first people to encounter this dam building process. And Hydro-Québec, as you report, Sam, you know, kind of did a little something to say sorry about your land. What did they do?
So that's sort of an interesting story. Hydro-Québec wanted to build a power line across the Pessimit's reservation. And there was this negotiation back and forth for the amount that the Pessimit would be compensated for this the power line being put through their what is clearly their land. The reservation is clearly land set aside.
Never mind those giant ancestral lands that were ruined.
Right. This is the tiny parcel set aside by the federal government explicitly for them. And as the negotiation goes back and forth, the number is between Indian Affairs, which is the federal. They're sort of like the fiduciary for the Pessimit. Their job is to represent the Pessimit's interest at the federal level. The number that was arrived on between in this negotiation between Hydro-Québec and the Indian Affairs representative was $200,000, $50,000 for the construction of the right of way, and then $150,000 for all impacts, past, present, and future, on the Pessimit hunting and fishing rights that had been damaged by the construction of these dams. And it's unclear the degree to which the Pessimit really understood what they were signing on for. But what their lawyer argues is that this deal was illegal regardless. So this was signed in 1973, and then 2 years later is when the Cree, having filed their injunction, actually managed to sign something called the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement, which for the impacts of hydroelectric development on their territory were paid, more than $100 million. And we said the math is 900 times more what the Pessmit were paid for hosting the first mega project.
So just 2 years later, but it seems like the Cree learned from what the Pessmit had been through, or were just better at maneuvering the system, or what, Sam?
I'd say it's sort of like right time, right place. It's unclear the degree to which they actually to which anyone knew that the Pessmit had suffered a similar fate at this time. I think that sort of came to light later. But the Crees knew that this was coming, and they had sort of smart young leaders who had gone to school and knew that in order to fight this, they would have to take it to the courts, essentially. And so it was just the right people being in place at the right time and having the right skill sets.
Well, and let's hear a little bit of that from the series, Sam. We're going to hear here from a former chief of one of the three, from one of the nine Cree communities. This is Robert Kanetawat. He's describing the legal strategy, and as you say, it was very smart that the Cree used to win more favorable reparations from Hydro-Québec than the Pessimist had won. So let's hear.
What they say, is that we weren't the owners of the land. They kept saying that. And we said that we managed to convince that they are trespassing, that they should pay for taking our land, our resources, our livelihood, and the way we want to live.
So we managed to say to the court, look, they're trespassing on our land. It's tough, though, Sam. I mean, this goes back centuries.
Yeah, and there's this whole history of making treaties with Native people that is part of the story, which is that the French arrived and they tended to interact fairly well with Native people. They sort of formed partnerships. This is where the fur trade was established in a lot of places. But then after British conquest of Canada, the British would, as they advanced westward, sort of from Ottawa on, would sign these treaties with Native people that got them to relinquish their right to the land. What that meant is that in Quebec and many of the eastern provinces, the Native people had never signed any sort of treaty saying like, oh yes, we give the land up onto you. And this question of whose land is this still was an unsettled question. And there's a lot of Canadian jurisprudence that we could dig into here, but I don't think we have time. And essentially what it came down to is there's the courts had acknowledged a right to be able to hunt and fish and practice their traditional way of life on this territory. And so when the Crees went to the court, they had to basically prove that their culture still existed. And so you had this situation where lawyers from Hydro-Québec were making arguments that these folks use bush planes to get themselves to and from their trapping territory. They eat toast. They eat Kentucky Fried Chicken. therefore, they're just like the rest
of us.
They're
not the real deal anymore.
And they don't have any right to this land.
I found that amusing in the series. They eat toast. Like, that's an argument to say that if they didn't use toasters, then,
And ultimately, the judge rejected this argument, and they won the injunction. However, the injunction was overturned on appeal, and Hydro-Québec was allowed to continue building the dams. But they were ordered to sit down and negotiate with the Crees, which is where this historic agreement that Robert Kanetawat, who we just heard from, signed, the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement.
Well, and you call in the series this James Bay Northern Quebec Agreement a thunderbolt, not just for the Cree, but you say it reimagined a whole new approach to land ownership and control. Give us a little bit more, Sam, there. How much did this affect other First Nation peoples.
Well, so this agreement actually became the model for what has become known as the modern comprehensive land claims process, which is how Canada sorts out the land claims that First Nations have over their territory. And it's basically this, they call it a forward-looking process where you sit down and you say, okay, you know, where was your territory? Where are we now? How can we come to some sort of agreement as to how to work together going forward? And the James Bay Northern Quebec Agreement is called the first modern treaty. It's the first instance of where this has occurred, and there have been successful modern treaties that have followed it. You know, the creation of Nunavut, the province that used to be part of Saskatchewan, I believe. I hope I didn't get that wrong. That was created as part of one of these processes. It has been difficult, though, and controversial, because what you do is you take, you know, Native people are able to say right now, if they've never signed a treaty, they're able to say, we've never given up the right to our land. But what rights they have remain sort of fuzzy and indistinct. So when you sit down and you negotiate a treaty, you give up the possibility of perhaps greater rights in order to cement and you know, be very sure of what rights the Canadian government has guaranteed you. And there's this whole process called extinguishment. So you're extinguishing the rights that you might have had a claim to in order to get the, you know, whatever it is Canada agrees for you to have, which has been very difficult for a lot of First Nations. They don't want to extinguish these traditional rights.
Well, sure. Once you sign on the dotted line, you're getting something, but you're giving up a ton, although you don't know in the end what you would have gotten, given that some of these claims go back, you know, hundreds of years, and there are lots of people living in these areas now and so forth. So.
Right, which explains why, you know, decades later, you still see that there are First Nations who have unsettled land claims that they've been negotiating with Canada for decades.
Well, and as you said, Sam, this James Bay Agreement was huge. It kind of set the stage for a whole new approach, but it doesn't mean that, you know, everything's all happy-dappy and that everybody gets what they want now. I want to play a little bit from David Schultz. He's a lawyer for the Pessimit, the group you talked about earlier, who did not do so well in its negotiations with Hydro-Québec. And he says, you know, even today, look, you know, James Bay was great for the Cree, but my clients, the Pessimit, would not receive as generous an agreement from Hydro-Québec as the Cree nations received. He says, that's just the reality. Let's hear.
The James Bay Northern Quebec Agreement was the first land claims agreement. It was the first modern treaty, and it is in many ways, it is a fantastic agreement. The problem is, and something Canada will never admit, is they'll never be that generous again because they didn't really know what they were doing. And what the Cree have under the James Bay Agreement is not really being offered anymore. I can tell you, I once had supper with a senior official in Indian Affairs who told me it's not a model for anyone, which I later realized is the epitome of the Indian Affairs view of the world, because she meant when she said not for anyone, she meant not for any of us white people back at Indian Affairs. So the James Bay Northern Quebec Agreement, yes, it is a great agreement. If Pessimit asked for it tomorrow, they wouldn't get it.
So the offer has expired, so to speak. And the Pessimit are trying to get more now, Sam. They're kind of going, whoa, what about us? This was terrible for our people. And they're trying to get a little bit more. What exactly do they want from Hydro-Québec?
That is an excellent question. I'm not sure if we could have a list of exactly the demands that they, you know, that if they have such a list, they've kept it rather close to the vest. They are following. Okay, so to take a step back, the Cree got the James Bay and Northern Quebec, the James Bay and Northern Quebec agreement. There were many pieces of that agreement that they didn't feel like were being lived up to by the Quebec government, the Canadian government, and so they continued to fight Hydro-Québec. Even though they had this historic agreement, there was another project proposed called the Great Whale Project, and the Cree continued to say no more development on our land until all these grievances are sorted out. And in so doing, they launched this international campaign where they went and petitioned the Pope. They went over to Europe to the International Water Tribunal. They went after the contract that Hydro-Québec had signed with New York State. So they took this canoe trip, as an Odiak. So they teamed up with the Inuits and built something that's a cross between a canoe and a kayak. They called it an Odiak. And they did just like a nonstop, months-long campaign of press conferences on every water body in sort of New England and New York.
They canoed all the way down to Manhattan, which makes you wonder how they did that, given that there's probably a couple hydroelectric dams. No irony there. But
well, the answer to that is that there was also a van that they put the canoe on the top of.
I love the sag wagon.
But there are these iconic images of the Cree paddling over to Manhattan, where they did these press conferences with Greenpeace, with the Sierra Club, with Robert Kennedy Jr. signed on to this project. And eventually there was enough international pressure that mounted over years of protest that New York State canceled the contract. A few years later, this was sort of a black eye. A few years later, the party in control of the Quebec government flipped, and the new Parti Québécois said, no, we need to focus on our campaign of pulling Quebec out of Canada, and therefore we're going to set this whole hydro development aside, and they shelved the Great Whale Project.
That's interesting. I thought you were going to say that the Parti Québécois said, no, this is part of our national pride, and we really need to push, doubly hard for this.
No, I think at this point it had become sort of an albatross that
made them look bad.
Yeah, exactly. And they didn't want to look bad at the same time as they were trying to become a new nation, right? Because in order to become a new nation, other countries have to recognize you. That's what makes you a nation is sort of the approval of the international community. And so the project was shelved. And this was a stinging defeat for Hydro-Québec.
And a huge victory for the Cree.
And it was. And it meant that for the better part of a decade, there was no hydro development happening. And so in the early 2000s, Hydro-Québec and the Quebec government approached the Cree and they said, listen, what can we do to make this right? And the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement was renegotiated. They found all the problems that the Crees have. They tried to find some sort of solution to them. They upped the compensation. There is an equivalent of about $3.5 billion over 50 years. It's about $70 million a year that's going to these Cree communities to help them with their public infrastructure. And it allowed the development of one more river. The Rupert River was diverted up into the reservoirs of the James Bay complex. That was called the Paix de Braves, the Peace of the Braves. It was signed in 2002. And I think this really caught the attention of a lot of First Nations, where they said, oh, this is how you win, right? You go outside of the borders of Quebec. You sort of name and shame. You try to link your grievances to modern day projects. And from my perspective, that's what the Pessimists are doing today. So they've been launching this campaign to come down to New England and try to link the Northern Pass project to the sort of degradation of salmon habitat on the Betsimut River. That's a tough fight, though, because it's very difficult when you look at the way the grid operates. It's very difficult to draw a direct link between a single one gigawatt power line and the operation of a single dam when you've got a fleet of 62 dams that any one of them could be energizing that power line. Regardless, though, that seems to be the game plan that the Pessimists are following.
But it's, as you say in the series, it's harder to sort of gin up public relations and public opposition. When the Cree were working on this, they had this giant project and, all these longstanding grievances.
Right. Well, if you think about it, I mean, the damage that is done to ecosystems and to salmon habitat are done at the point that a dam is constructed, mostly. There are a few things that happen after the construction of a dam, but it's the interruption of this natural ecosystem that changes things that could, if a project is poorly designed, could lead to a decline in habitat. And so the Crees, they were standing in the way of the project. They're saying, if we do something now, the project's not going to get built. Whereas the Pessimists have to say, listen, this project was built 45 years ago, but we deserve some compensation for it, and perhaps we could sort of nibble around the edges as to how the dam is operated.
Well, coming up, Sam, we should start to talk about how First Nation Canadians feel about hydropower today? Because you ask them about that, and it is a mixed picture. It's not what you might expect, given what happened on their lands. We should also talk a little bit more about the case that's often made for hydro, which is that it's clean and green. And as you say in the series, if you wanted a cut and dry, clear narrative, sorry, that's not what this is all about. So we'll definitely go into that after a short break. Got a couple emails, too, that I'd like to share with you. You can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And we'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, Canadian hydropower and the complicated history of Hydro-Québec. It's a tale told through a new series by NHPR's Outside In. Host Sam Evans-Brown is with us. He and producer Hannah McCarthy travel to the far reaches of northern Canada to explore this story. Their four-part series will air starting tomorrow at 3. Or check out the Outside In podcast to listen to all four pieces now. You can join us as well with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Sam, here's an email that came in from Maddie, who says, is there a viable solution to removing all the dams and regaining the native way of life? Maddie also says, is this green energy or not? Is the planet more important than a given culture? Maddie says, it rankles me how everybody signals about climate change, but actual efforts at mitigating it are stymied. And I'm skeptical of the hysteria, but I'm all for renewable energy. He concludes by saying, what happened is wrong, but it's done. These are fundamental questions that I think you try to answer in this series, Sam. So let's tackle them. First of all, is this green energy or not?
That's the big one, right?
That would take us another 45 minutes.
Well, so every source of energy has its own impacts. The impacts often are incredibly different, and so they're difficult to measure against each other. You know, if you have something that rooftop solar is a great example, where it creates very little habitat impact. It's zero carbon except for when the solar panels are manufactured. But it is more expensive even than utility scale solar. If you build a giant solar farm, it's much cheaper than doing one rooftop here or there. And so okay, we're talking about the cost, the intermittency problem versus habitat destruction with hydropower versus air impacts with burning fossil fuels. So how do you weigh those against each other is sort of the fundamental problem with deciding what energy mix you want to have, because you're weighing different values, and people will attribute different worth to all those different values. So I am going to not answer the question of is hydropower green energy or not, because it's simply a value call, and I think that it's up to each person to make that judgment for themselves.
So it's certainly not green when these lands are destroyed, and you know the whole flow of the river and all the plants and animals that depend on it are destroyed.
Let's talk about the impacts of large-scale hydropower, right? You create a massive reservoir. That reservoir upstream floods a lot of land, which covers up vegetation, covers up habitat, maybe covers wetlands, and turns them into a lake. You go from a river to a lake. Lakes are, in terms of biodiversity, at the edge of the lake, there's a lot of biodiversity. As you get towards the middle, they're kind of like a desert. There's not a ton of life in a lake. lake compared to wetlands, which are incredibly species dense and provide a lot of ecosystem services. So
lots of destruction there.
Lots of destruction of habitat. You also alter the flow regime of the river downstream, and depending on the river, that can be really dramatic. So the Betsimit River that we talked about, that's the, sort of the namesake of the Pessimit people, that's a very silty and clay-y river. The banks are very unstable. So when Hydro-Québec raises or lowers the reservoir levels, there's a lot of erosion. And when I spoke to a couple of scientists about this, they said that probably erosion is worse on that river because of the way it's being used for hydropower. So these are all impacts. There's also methyl mercury. So as you flood a reservoir and plant life begins to decay, there's this spike where suddenly that new reservoir has all sorts of mercury in it that is coming from natural sources and the levels are higher than they would have been if that flooding had never occurred.
Plants that are newly underwater and they have a biological reaction that is not helpful.
Right, exactly, and that's a natural reaction, but it happens more because there are more plants that have been flooded. And so for a number of years, maybe 15, 20 years after a reservoir is created, there are higher levels of methyl mercury in the fish. And so if there are people fishing, they have to limit their consumption of the fish from that reservoir.
Yikes.
So these are all the impacts that come from large-scale hydropower. They're quantifiable. We can look at them. We can get our hands around them. But then how you weigh those against the impacts of other energy sources is a value judgment that I leave up to the listeners.
Well, and as Maddie says, what's happened is wrong, but it's done. And you talked to some of the First Nation Canadians about this, how they feel about hydropower, given what happened, given the impacts, but given that it's here now and is not a fossil fuel. I want to play a little bit, Sam, from Violet Pachano. She's a former chief and deputy grand chief with the Cree. That's the group that had a more beneficial agreement with Hydro-Québec. And here's how she responds to your question, how should New Englanders think about Canadian hydropower?
I guess there's some guilt in appreciating the power, making life easier, work easier. Yeah, I guess it should just be in the conscience of people what's happening and where this comes from and what has happened. But do you see, what do we do about global warming, you know? And people are talking about it too, like the elders, they talk about the difference, what was then, how the winters were, and the summers. And I remember all that. And now, like, this river doesn't freeze.
Again, that's Cree leader Violet Pachano talking about how she feels about hydropower, given what happened, yes, but also given concerns over climate change. And Sam, you also talked to another big Cree leader, one of the gentlemen who, I think he was in his 80s now, but he signed that big, giant, important James Bay Agreement. How did he feel about hydro today?
Yeah, so both of them, I sort of talked to them back to back, and it was actually completely fascinating to me because Violet Pachano, first of all, one of the things that she said is that when she was little, she lived this traditional nomadic lifestyle, and she used to have to go to the river and fill a pot with water and heat it on the fire when she wanted to wash her clothes. And so the degree to which she appreciated her electric washing machine was one of those things that she personally feels guilty about, but at the same time, she's really glad she has that washing machine, right? So this is sort of the push-pull that I think all of us feel when it comes to getting power. And then Robert Kanatawat, who I talked to right after Violet Pachano, surprised me, totally blew me away by saying, you know, this is someone who spent his entire life fighting against hydropower development, essentially, by saying that he thought hydropower was a better source of electricity than intermittent renewables like wind and solar and burning things like natural gas. And he told this story about how a lot of the Cree used to live in these sort of unheated camps in the winter and heated with wood stove by burning wood. And these days, some of them are building more modern camps, actual cabins out on their hunting and trapping territory, and they're putting propane in them. And he told a story about how five trappers that he knew had set set up their cabin with propane. There was a leak. They all were unconscious. There was a spark. It burned down, and five people were killed.
Wow.
And so he says—
The dangers of fossil fuels.
Exactly. And so he said, this sort of elder statesman of the indigenous rights movement told me that he thought hydropower was, you know, it's not perfect, but it's he saw it as a good source of energy.
Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Or send us an email like Maddie did. And Maddie, thank you for that one. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Something that really jumped out at me, Sam, from this series, and again, there's so much here, but you do talk about how after especially that big James Bay agreement and the real feisty fight that the Cree put up, that Hydro-Québec adopted a newer approach toward Native outreach. You say it really kind of became a different company. What do you mean by that?
Well, so it wasn't so the Pays de Braves happened in 2002. In 2004, there was a Supreme Court decision that now, whenever there is development on territory that there's some sort of Native group that would be impacted, there's a duty to consult and compensate for any damages done to that territory. So it was not just there was a shift in a Hydro-Québec strategy. They wanted to get community buy-in whenever they built a project, so they wouldn't have the experience of the Great Whale Fight, where they spend all sorts of money to do the planning for a project and then have it, you know, defeated.
Right,
by...
it blew up in their face. I mean, even Mario Cuomo, as you said, pulled out of the deal. Go ahead.
Yes. So there was a shift in strategy, but then there's also now a constitutional duty to consult and consult and accommodate, as the exact language. So now, whenever Hydro-Québec goes to develop a project, the first thing they do is they reach out to the impacted First Nations, and they make a deal. And so the latest project that is still being developed today is on the Romaine River. So if you look at a map and sort of go straight north from Nova Scotia, there's the big Anacostia Island in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. The Romaine River is straight north of that. So very, very far from Quebec City and Montreal. And there's four dams being built on it. And there were four Innu communities that had native territories that would be impacted by this development. And Hydro-Québec cut four individual deals with those four communities that resulted in compensation. And the largest was to a community called Equanichit. The deal, you know, this is a very small town, essentially 600 people. And the deal is for $75 million over about 60 years. So it's about $1 million, $1 point something million in benefits to that community per year. And when the chief and band council were opposed to sitting down to negotiating, but they put it to the community, and the community voted 70% in favor of negotiating a deal and letting Hydro-Québec build this river. So it's really a very different model. Whereas in the 70s, it was about, you know, announce, start construction, fight it out in the courts. Now it's sort of go to the community, reach out to them. What are your concerns? How can we deal with them? Change the project, and then eventually sign a deal and enter into development afterward.
Well, and you mentioned in the series that, you know, not only do they have this obligation on paper, but the company has hired people who really, you know, walk the walk, don't just talk the talk. I want to play a little bit from Sonia Burgess. She's a French-Canadian native. She works as a liaison or a point person with First Nation peoples on this Romaine project that you mentioned. And she told you, Sam, she really, really cares about the neighboring Equanichit tribe. For her, she says, it's personal.
I have a niece and nephew from Equanichit, so that's not my, and I'm emotional, sorry, but that's my family too, you know? So we want to do good things with the people, you know? Hydro is there's people who work for Hydro, and we have good intentions, you know? And we're not perfect, but we are working with the people, and we want to work with them. So I hope you give this message with all the rest of the message you want to give. I hope you give this one.
It's a really emotional moment there. I mean, she's not just, you know, working for the company and following the company policy. She feels this.
Yeah, I would say that, and I heard this from people who've been working with the Cree government for decades as well, that there's been a real culture change at the company. Whereas in the past, perhaps there was a certain level of dismissiveness toward Native concerns. Now the people who are being hired by the company genuinely care, are genuinely interested in listening, and doing their part to address the concerns of the Native people. And you know, it's worth pointing out, though, that's the result of decades of fighting. I mean, this culture change has come about because it's been demanded by the indigenous people impacted by these projects.
Bitterness remains. It's not all one big happy story, as you remind us again and again. And I want to ask you a little bit, Sam, about this next clip before we play it. You and Hannah and a spokesperson for one of the chiefs and the chief himself, you all went to visit a Hydro-Québec facility, and they didn't let you in. So just give us the backstory on that, please.
So this is with Chief Jean-Charles Pietacho, who's the chief of Equanichit. As part of the deal, they received money to create a Native-owned helicopter company. And that company had all sorts of contracts to do work for Hydro-Québec on the construction of the Romaine project. So this is one of the benefits that they got when they signed this deal. He wanted to show us the helicopters, and he wanted to take us up in one of them, so we could see the dams from the air, essentially. However, they were at the work site; they were up at Romaine 4, which is still under construction. And so, to get there, we had to drive all the way up the access road that Hydro-Québec has created to access these remote rivers. We didn't put in our security clearance soon enough. This is in part because we didn't know that this was something that was on the table. We had a really hard time getting in touch with Jean-Charles Pietacho before we finally met with him in person. And so when we got to the security checkpoint, we were turned around. And Jean-Charles was outraged because he's the chief. This is their native land. This is land that he doesn't feel like they should have to ask permission to come onto with his guests. And so he started to make calls with folks, his contacts higher up at Hydro-Québec. I actually eventually spoke to the person who was on the other end of that call, and it was an uncomfortable phone conversation for everyone involved. And he threatened to come back and blockade the road, which is a tactic that indigenous activists frequently use whenever they're unhappy with development projects. And Hannah and I are in the back seat, and we're sort of, you know,
listening to all this.
Yeah, and we're feeling like this is spiraling out of control. And but anyways, when we had to turn the car around, the chief became very angry with us because he basically asked, how would they have known that you were journalists, and how would they have known that because he had asked other guests to come up with a very short notification, and Hydro-Québec had said yes, but they said no to us because we were journalists. And we said, well, we did interviews with them. They know that we're here. And he said, well, you didn't tell me that you did interviews. And I said, well, I didn't. I mean, I assume
that's what journalists do.
Exactly.
You
talked to
all
sides.
And sure.
And he became very angry. And as we spent this very long, tense car ride trying to sort out why he was so angry, and it became clear that this was a slight, and he felt that it's sort of part of a pattern of abuses that First Nations people feel, going back through the decades. And, it sounds like we don't have time to listen to the clip, so I encourage people to download the podcast where you can hear sort of the outcome of this. But it was very illuminating for us. It made it clear that we Americans had sort of stumbled our way into the center of something that's very complicated and very tender.
You know, Sam, we are running out of time, and I can't believe it, because there's so much more we should talk about. So you're right. Folks should download the podcast or start listening tomorrow at 3. But what do you hope listeners get from these four pieces, besides that it's just a great story beautifully told?
Well, what I hope that people take away from this is that there are no easy answers, especially when it comes to how we're going to power a society that is as complicated and as wonderful as the one we've created. And so before you dismiss any single source of power, think very hard about all of the impacts. And when you say no to one source of power, what are you saying yes to?
All right. Sam, I hope folks check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Outside In is where you should look. The series is called Powerline. It starts on the air tomorrow at 3. And Sam, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
¶¶
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.